Hello there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Bro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Bro, and I will be your host for today's show. Now, as always, I'm joined by Tom Basson, Sports Bro's news editor, and alongside him today, we have yet more editorial royalty in Sam Karp, our features editor. Sam and Tom, good to be joined by you.
Thanks, George. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and nice to be back. Nice of you to make room for the little guy after your guys' recent excursions down to Sky Studios and Tom's big interview with Gary Lineker. So yeah, good to be back on.
You're trailing things that haven't come into pass yet, Sam. The Sky Studios big revelation is all yet to come.
But, I'm just teasing people, Tom. Teasing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, listen up for a very interesting interview me and George did down with the people at Kind Folk at Sky.
It was a great day. I'm just surprised you can see us there, Tom, from all the way up there in your ivory tower.
Why am I in the ivory tower? You were there as well.
That was just an excuse to put a peep show quote in right. there. But, you know, I'm sure there'll be some listeners that notice that. Anyway, let's talk about some serious matters. Tom, I'm going to go to you first. The Solheim Cup starting this week.
Yes, Solheim Cup is starting this week. Probably the most high-profile women's golf tournament. This one's particularly, I think, an interesting one. Comes at an interesting time with women's golf actually on a pretty decent upward trajectory. The LPGA is enjoying a particularly strong moment, I think. The tour is looking good. It's got a really nice balance of players from all over the globe. Good American interest. There's good European interest. And that creates a great Solheim Cup. Also, this is it's an interesting Solheim Cup in that it's probably going to be, well, it will be the last time that it's ever played the week before a Ryder Cup. As a result of COVID and some other things in the calendar, they've decided to move some things around and they're switching the tournament from odd to even years. So we'll have another Solheim Cup next year. But this one in Spain is going to be literally played in the week building up to the Ryder Cup, which it may be one of those things that when they've completed it and when they've both been played, they may look back and go like, oh, are we sure we don't want to be doing this more in the future? But at the same time, there certainly is an argument for the Solheim Cup being a standalone and perhaps wanting to be outside of the shadow of the Ryder Cup, which is a massive event in the golf calendar and the sporting calendar, really.
Sam, you recently caught up with Molly Marcoux-Simon, Commissioner of the LPGA. Ahead of this year's Solheim Cup, what was sort of your take and her view on the position that women's golf finds itself in at the moment?
Yeah, it seems to be in pretty good health, to be honest. The LPGA itself, as Tom kind of alluded to there, record tournaments this year, record prize money, broken the $100 million mark for the first time, and players on course earnings as well, improving. Last year, 27 LPGA players earned more than $1 million in prize money, which was up from 15 in 2021. Prize money for the majors have been improving all the time. Prize money for non-majors as well. They're awarding $66 million in prize money for those tournaments this year, which is 43% growth from 2021. So they're in a really good spot to kind of build on where they are now. And that's kind of, I think, essentially the work that Marcoux-Simon is doing at the moment. She's been there for a couple of years now, and it's been a period of growth, as those kind of numbers illustrate. And those foundations were kind of laid by her predecessor, Mike Wan, who took on a kind of an ailing tour, to be honest. It needed more tournaments, it needed more prize money, and he delivered that. And he essentially turned the LPGA into golf's global tour. Like, you look at the PGA Tour and the men's tournament, it's very US-centric. Most of the tournaments are in the States. Whereas if you look at the LPGA, they've got a lot of tournaments in Asia. They have a European swing. Obviously, they still have their tournaments over in the US as well, but there's a lot more of a global feel to it. That's kind of something that they're looking to capitalize on, have been able to capitalize on already. Yeah, so the Solheim Cup kind of comes at a good time for the game. I think sort of the whole Ryder Cup conversation is an interesting one. I'm not so sure that it is a good thing that they've been held back to back. I know that circumstances have kind of forced it to be that way. I feel like the build-up has been kind of completely overshadowed by the fact that the Ryder Cup is happening immediately after. I don't feel like I've heard as much about the Solheim Cup, just kind of candidly, anecdotally, it sort of doesn't seem to have dominated the news quite as much, which is just kind of indicative of the way that the media covers sport, isn't it? If they have an option between covering the men's tournament or the women's tournament, most media companies are going to lend more coverage to the men's because they know it's going to generate more traffic at this moment in time. They know it's going to generate more conversation. And I feel like that's the route that a lot of media companies have sadly gone down.
It's an interesting dilemma because, Tom, we were talking yesterday about the pros and cons of co-programming men and women's events. And we looked at the Ashes in particular. Sorry again to take it back to cricket. But we looked at, you know, the success that the Ashes has seen by co-programming their events side by side through the summer. But it's really interesting because that success is very much determined after the fact, right? When you see the viewership metrics, you see the interest that takes place over the summer or over the course of the tournament. But as you say, there's a bit of a risk that that actually can overshadow when you co-promote both brands together, because sometimes the men's coverage takes priority.
I think what's interesting as well is that, I guess with the Ashes, it was all being organized by the same governing bodies. The Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup aren't organised by the same body. So obviously the Ryder Cup is put on by the PGA of America and Ryder Cup Europe. And then the Solheim Cup is organised by the LPGA and the Ladies European Tour. So there's not really like that incentive there necessarily for them to promote each other's tournaments. There's not necessarily the incentive for the Ryder Cup organisers to lend their resources to promote an event that's happening before theirs. Their focus naturally is going to be on the Ryder Cup. So I don't think it's that much of a surprise, but it does feel like a bit of a missed opportunity because ever since this kind of clash became apparent, both sides have described it as a bit of a 2-week festival of golf. And then actually could have been opportunities for crossover. You know, there's two teams, there's 12 men, 12 women competing for Europe, 12 men, 12 women competing for the US. You know, what kind of content opportunities could that have created? It feels like there could have been a lot of cross promotion. I don't really follow it. There has been that. So it's a bit of a shame, but as I said, sort of circumstances dictated that this is the way it's had to be. But I do think the clash has kind of taken away a little bit, that took the spotlight away a little bit from the build up to the Solheim Cup.
Tom, do you think those challenges are insurmountable, as Sam talked about? I mean, it does not just involve people sitting down in the same room, looking at the opportunities of co-promotion and sort of not co-branding necessarily, but utilizing each other's strengths to create that festival of golf. Do you think it's too late as well?
I think it is too late, but that's not to say that it's a wasted opportunity. It might not come down to the organisations. I think it could also come down to like the broadcasters who are airing it, right? Like, as I said, we've been at Sky. I imagine they're kind of quite happy about it. Like, for them, it is pretty good. They get the run in from one tournament to the other. They have that 2-week festival of golf. I would be interested to see afterwards, like, whether or not it comes out that actually Sky got really good numbers for the Solheim Cup and how much they attribute that to it being the week before the Ryder Cup. We'll probably get a chance to find out kind of straight away almost like what the impact of that is, because we jump straight from the Solheim Cup in Spain this year to Virginia next year and then back to the Netherlands in 2026. So by this point next year, we'll know whether or not there was any kind of impact one way or the other, and whether or not those two being close together was positive or negative. So it's interesting they've already made that decision on where the next one is after that, or that they'd already decided that they didn't want to be aligned. And perhaps the fact that they'd already decided that was why there wasn't so much co-promotion. Like, what's the point in putting resources into something where ultimately you've already made the decision to move on from that model anyway? I don't know whether or not it will have a massive impact, like a bit of social or a bit of cross-promotion between the tours. I think we'll probably see a bit more of that happen. Like, there's a joint PGA Tour and LPGA Tour event later this year, which we will see a bit more of, like a bit more collaboration. There's already a joint LET and European Tour event, which happens earlier in the calendar too. So that's your opportunity, I think, where they're working together. Golf kind of in that odd position where it's got all of these different stakeholders and they kind of collaborate, but at the same time, they don't. It could definitely be better if they did. And maybe it will take, I don't know, an outside force to do that. One thing I do think is quite interesting about the Solheim Cup, or like where the Solheim Cup is vastly different, is the potential for like the other side of the tournament, right? So like the reason why the Ryder Cup makes sense is because men's golf's two power bases are North America and Europe. Whereas in women's golf, golf's power bases are really North America and Asia. With the strength of the game in Asia, I think potentially we could see the Solheim Cup not being usurped, because I think it'll always be a big interest. I think like it's got that history on its side now, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point there was another tournament launched. I mean, the President's Cup has become a more prominent part of the golf calendar in recent years with the growth of the men's game outside of Europe and the US. But given the amount of high quality players that you get in the women's golf major, I think that might be the direction in which that team format goes, is that you'll see a competition where that brings those two forces together.
Yeah. Why does it even have to be a new tournament? Why can't you just rejig the Solheim Cup? I feel like the Solheim Cup's held back a little bit by the fact that it's always compared to the Ryder Cup. You know, if you were to give the elevator pitch to someone about what the Solheim Cup is, you're probably going to say, oh, it's the female equivalent of the Ryder Cup, which I don't think is particularly helpful for anyone. You know, why does the Solheim Cup have to follow the same format, have to go down exactly the same route and kind of expect it to work? I think the Solheim Cup, because it's been around for less time, you know, it was established in 1990. The Ryder Cup's been around since the 1920s, I think. It feels more ripe for change. It feels like there'd be less pushback. Yes, you kind of have that rivalry there already between North America and Europe that's existed because of the Ryder Cup. But as Tom alluded to there, the playing field and the talent pool in women's golf is much more diverse. I had a quick look at like the top 25 players in women's golf. I think something like 15 in the top 25 in the Rolex rankings. I hope those are the right ones to be looking at, are from outside the US and Europe. So essentially in the Solheim Cup this weekend, a ton of the sport's biggest stars aren't going to be there. So, you know, rather than necessarily creating a new tournament, what have you created? A sort of, I don't know how this would work logistically, create a sort of three-pronged tournament where you have a team from Europe, a team from North America, and a team from the rest of the world, where you get all those players from Asia in, you get the likes of Brooke Henderson in from Canada, and you sort of give that exposure to all of those players on a global stage. You'd imagine that because of that, the value of the rights would go up, sponsors would become more interested because it is this global event with global appeal. And yeah, the value of the tournament generally becomes more interesting to all stakeholders. I mean, again, I don't know how that would work logistically. There'd probably be quite a lot of hurdles to overcome. But I feel, as I mentioned, because the Solheim Cup is younger, it's not kind of tied back by the tradition of the men's game, there is that kind of opportunity to innovate and do things a little bit differently.
It's definitely got that. I mean, that's also not to say that the Solheim Cup hasn't been successful. Like the last one that was actually completed under normal conditions in 2019 was at Gleneagles, and they got 90,000 people at Gleneagles over the weekend for that tournament. It came down to the last couple of matches on the day and like made for a really compelling viewing. And like women's golf, it has that. It's got a lot of stars, like a very kind of nicely even distributed level of stars, which is why the LPGA Tour has been so strong recently, that can kind of come up and take any tournament. It's the same on the PGA Tour at the moment. Actually, there's quite a good amount of parity with a couple of big stars. But like, it works in the Solheim Cup. There's strength on both sides, I think, at the moment, and there are weaknesses on both sides at the moment. So it's still, I think, a good enough product as it is. But yeah, I think the fact that, as you allude to, Sam, that you can miss out on that many of the big names in the sport not playing what is probably the most high-profile tournament in the women's golf calendar, that is a problem that probably does need addressing at some point.
Come on, Tom. We're not about good enough on the Sports Road podcast. We're about high quality, high performance excellence.
I can't believe you just used the word high performance on this podcast.
And to be fair, just like, there's pretty good numbers going into this weekend as well. I think organisers did an announcement earlier this week saying they're expecting more than 85,000 attendees over the course of the event. You know, general admission tickets going for €80, which is quite a lot of money, but the fact people are paying it shows that the Solheim Cup is an attractive proposition for event goers.
And in Spain too. I mean, we think of it as like a place to go play golf because it's like a hot country, and I don't know, like England footballers go out and have their like summers there or whatever, and you see them on the golf course, but it's not got the same golf club tradition as the UK and even Scandinavia. It's still viewed as a very elite sport there. If they're taking the Solheim Cup to a new market and still getting that level of interest, I think it says it's in a quite strong position.
Yeah. Well, I think it is also, I guess, Costa del Sol, where it's being held. Costa del Sol has sponsored their season ending event and held it for the last few years. So they have the race of the Costa del Sol. So it's kind of not, golf isn't unfamiliar, or women's golf particularly isn't unfamiliar. So they kind of, you'd sort of imagine that the demand for this event is hopefully a product of, you know, that presence that they've had there over the last few years. But as you alluded to there, it kind of feels like in Europe in particular, it's beneficial for them to be taking this event to new markets. You know, you think about over in the US, wherever the Solheim Cup's played, golf's massive in the US. So people, it's going to be well attended. I think there were 130,000 people at the last one. If you stage the Solheim Cup in England or Scotland, generally you're going to get a pretty good turnout. But it's more of a test to grow it in other markets. And if you look at kind of the makeup of the European team in the Solheim Cup over the years, it's typically been UK, Scandinavia as well, as you alluded to just there, Tom. So by taking it into markets like Spain, by taking it into markets like the Netherlands in 2026, I guess the knock-on impact of that is that you're going to get more women playing golf, and you know, it's going to become more prominent across the continent as opposed to in those sort of hotbeds that it's in at the moment.
Before we move on, I'm going to ask you to play some golfing blackjack. You're Molly Marcoux-Simon. You're looking at the format of the Solheim Cup, looking at the successes that we've seen the past few years and the plans in place for the next few years. Are you sticking or twisting with the format, Tom?
Well, the logistical challenges at the moment are also contractual too. So there would be some things there that they'd have to address. IMG, for example, who are signed on to manage the Solheim Cup until 2038, would probably have a say in what happens. But I would definitely say twist. I don't know if there's a three-team format that could work. I haven't thought of that far in advance. But the fact that you could tap into the Asian market and you've only got to look at what's going on elsewhere in the sports ecosystem. The Premier League has been doing this for years. The NBA is actively trying to do this too. If you've got a good route into Asia and you've got a big fan base there, you've got a big playing public, you've got a lot of interest, I don't know why you wouldn't. So if they can make it work, I would definitely twist and try and get those players from South Korea into the tournament for sure.
Pragmatic optimism. It's the Tom Bassam siren cry. Sam, stick or twist?
Twist. One word answer, mate. That's all I need.
I like it. Short and sharp. Now, before we move on to part two, where I know Tom has an interview with Pam Wayfinding coming up, Sam, been an interesting few days for you with the rematch.
Yeah, interesting night. I mean, I've been thinking about it for a few days after, but I had a good night out last week while you guys were all at the pub after our Sports Pro Sports Day. I traveled along to Dock X in Canada Water. The way I describe it, have either of you been to Secret Cinema before?
Yes.
Which one did you go to?
Canary Wharf, I think.
Which show though?
Good question. The Notebook.
Did you go solo, George?
I didn't see that coming. What were you going to say?
The Notebook was the most romantic part of that evening.
I was expecting Dirty Dancing or Stranger Things, but
maybe I'm conflating two things. It may not have been Secret Cinema.
It could have been a rooftop cinema thing too.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, that kind of vibe. Basically, I'd been really talking about going to the Stranger Things one a few years ago. Bottled it because I thought I was too old to do it. Later, my mates went, said it was amazing. You're never too old, basically. That's the message. But Secret Cinema, obviously, is an immersive theatre experience where you get your ticket, you go along, you dress up like a character in the film or the show or an outfit from that era, and you essentially become part of it. You become part of that show. The actors are kind of performing all around you. You're not sat in a seat. You're moving around. Yeah, it's a very immersive experience. So think of that, but for sport. And you have Rematch, which is basically a company that was formed a few years ago by Richard Ayres, who is the founder of Seven League, the digital sports consultancy that's part of IMG. And it basically describes itself as basically recreating iconic sporting moments through immersive theatrical events. The first one they did was around Wimbledon in the 1980s, and they had basically sort of a recreation of Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe's final that year, but that was quite a small run. I think it was they needed a few shows, whereas
I think I saw that where they had a digital screen on the floor of the court, right, and where the ball would land, you'd see almost a flashing light where it would land.
It's all very, very creative the way they reproduce it. And so last week the one I went to is their latest effort, which is the Rumble in the Jungle, which feels like a lot more of a significant undertaking than Wimbledon in the 1980s. Not to say that putting on Wimbledon isn't a complex undertaking, but Rumble in the Jungle was...
You don't want to get that one wrong, do you?
No. Rumble in the Jungle was, at the time, this global event, one of the most watched sporting events in history. I think it had a global television audience of a billion people, so I'm told. Yeah, but there are also a load of kind of underlying narrative, political, racial stuff going on at the time. So yeah, to fit all that into 3 hours is a bit of a challenge, but it was a really, really entertaining night. Came away from it pretty impressed with what I saw.
It's a concept which has got quite a lot of potential, right? There's so many things you could do with it. I mean, obviously you've mentioned Wimbledon. This is another sort of big thing from the past, but you could even make up new sports events or new experiences. It doesn't have to be something that's already existed. Or do you think then it would lose its appeal?
I think the appeal of it is that I do think it has to be a historic event that's going to appeal to a mass audience. So you think of Rumble in the Jungle. When I went along the other night, I went as someone who has heard of Rumble in the Jungle and know that it was a like historic fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. But I went along not really knowing the wider context of the event. I didn't really know everything that had happened. So as someone who, you know, wasn't alive when that event happened, I went along to kind of learn about it and experience it for the first time. And bringing it to life in that way felt quite different to just watching a YouTube video or a documentary, because you're kind of, yeah, you're seeing it play out in front of you. You're seeing press conferences. When I first walked into the sort of main festival room, this guy kind of hobbled over to me and shook my hand, and I was kind of affronted. I was like, what's going on here? And it turned out he was an actor playing George Foreman's trainer, and just proceeds to like give you a little bit of context about everything.
Did you enjoy that? Did you join in?
I actually really enjoyed it. I was with my brother, who was incredibly awkward and sort of kept sort of shying away and being like, we should go now, we should go. So we kind of avoided the wandering actors after that. What I'm trying to get at is that it's that historic element of it creates something for everyone. So for me, it's kind of someone who's curious about sport, a sporting event that's happened. But you also had people there, I guess, who were perhaps alive at the time and just kind of wanted to relive that era. They wanted to go back to the 70s. They were dressed up. They wanted to listen to the music of that time. And yeah, just kind of relive that sort of moment in their lives. You know, I feel like at the moment when we're sort of in a cost of living crisis and all that sort of stuff, it's, you know, people do have kind of a bit of a longing for
nostalgia.
Yeah, it tugs at those nostalgic heartstrings a little bit, these kind of experiences. So yeah, I think there's definitely legs in the concept, whether it could be for kind of like, as you mentioned, Tom, just completely new things. I don't know if that would work, but I see loads of potential in it. Like, you could, this has been, you know, they've done their production so far in London, but what if you went to India and did their first Cricket World Cup win in 1983? You know, you'd imagine that would go down pretty well in that market. If you're thinking about events that are also politically charged, recreating like Jesse Owens at the 1936 Olympics and providing the context and all that. And then on a like even more granular level, club specific stuff, like I'd imagine there'd be a lot of, if you took a sort of a tour of Manchester United's 1999 Champions League final win against Bayern Munich and, you know, retelling the story around that, I don't know, I imagine that would go down pretty well given, you know, Man United's global fan base, for example. So I think there's tons of things you can do with it. I guess it's just a matter of having the resource and investment to be able to do that, because it did feel like, you know, it's a massive set. The actors have had to learn an incredible amount of stuff to do this. Like, you know, to the extent that the guys playing Ali and Foreman were just completely mirroring what was happening in the fight in terms of the movements and that kind of stuff. So it seems really intricate, but a really cool idea at the same time.
I think one thing that jumps out to me as being, you know, really cool on that concept is blending, you know, the cultural side with the sporting side. If I think to my favorite sports documentaries or my favorite like non-live sporting content, it is almost always where those two are blended. And there's a, you really get inside the narrative, particularly sports that you may not follow particularly closely. You know, if you compare something like All or Nothing from Amazon, it's essentially a chronological retelling of what's happened the previous season with a bit of narrative that feels very editorially controlled from the outside. So yes, it's fun to see a little bit behind the scenes. It's fun to, you know, relive a great season, you know, for Spurs fans, maybe not for their documentary, but...
Or Arsenal fans for theirs, to be fair.
No, Tom. But if you compare that to The Last Dance, for instance, and you chart some of the incredible personal side or contextual elements to Michael Jordan and the Bulls. You know, you think of him coming back after his father's death, for instance, and how that really drove him in that comeback season, or so many different elements. I think, you know, what makes sport great is often the stories that are told around it. And Rumble in the Jungle is probably one of the best examples of where those two are inextricably linked. Same with Jesse Owens, as you mentioned. So the opportunity to really lean into that and to educate people and for someone to come away, you know, thinking, wow, I actually had no idea what was happening around that time, why it felt so significant, why it was such an incredible, you know, rise against the odds, whatever it might be. You know, if you think of Tyson Fury, you know, in 10, 15 years time, you retell that story against the backdrop of his mental health and weight issues, for instance. It's an incredibly powerful narrative that makes the sporting pinnacle of that story even more incredible. You know, in an age where you've got YouTube and you can watch basically any sporting event at any time in its entirety, really, that doesn't seem to me as the thing that would set it apart, but where they're blended together.
That's the kind of thing of like where it goes. And like, I think your point about club stuff and other big moments, it's probably just going to come down to the real resource that's available to that for sports organisations, whether or not they've got that extra cash to put into something like this, what the return on that is as well, I guess.
You'd look at it and be, I mean, for example, Rumble in the Jungle, this one's running, I think, throughout September and October. If you were to get to that level, you'd probably look at doing like one-off events or something and sort of, yeah, maybe two shows or whatever and that kind of thing. Like, you could imagine that they'd look at, yeah, they'd do it in according to demand. But I think, yeah, I think it still has potential on that level as well as the kind of global scale. So maybe it wouldn't require as much if you were to do those kind of smaller shows with it. But yeah, I'd imagine they're quite selective in what they choose as well.
If you were executive producers, what sporting event would you want to see recreated?
Oh, I think I would love to go inside the Brazil 1998 World Cup final and the retelling of what happened to original Ronaldo. I think there's so many things there you could recreate in that sort of drama. The tournament itself was a great tournament, but that final and everything that happened with it, and then it culminating in France winning at home and all of the kind of stuff that happened afterwards with like Brazil, the Federation and Nike. And there's just so much there that you could tell. I think that would be a great story.
Hard to follow that one up, but probably the 1997 first division playoff final when David Hopkin curled it in the top corner in the last minute to send Palace to the Premier League. Yeah, didn't give that one that much thought, but I'd quite like to relive that. How about you, George?
I realise I've asked this question and I've been frantically searching the depths of my brain for an answer. My immediate thought was the 2019 World Cup cricket final, but that feels almost criminal. It would probably be the Headingley test of Botham's Ashes.
Yeah, that bloke needs more exposure for sure. part two is a conversation featuring myself and Stephen Minning, co-founder and CEO of PAM Wayfinding, where he tells us all about some of the technology that backs up SoFi Stadium and its Hollywood Park home. Check that out now. Stephen Minning, welcome to the Sports Pro podcast. We're here to talk about PAM Wayfinding and your work at Hollywood Park and SoFi Stadium, probably the most technologically advanced stadium in the world, you'd probably say.
I'd definitely say so.
Until the next one gets built anyway. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview of your relationship with that project and what exactly it is you did at SoFi Stadium and perhaps why it matters?
Yeah, sure, 100%. So SoFi Stadium really is a unique project. I know there will be other stadiums that are built to a similar size and scale, but Los Angeles is also a very unique place on the face of the planet. And the 2028 Olympics was also, this is kind of jewel in that crown. So they had Olympic infrastructure within Los Angeles, but this is going to be the centerpiece, the opening and closing ceremonies for the Olympics in Los Angeles. So in terms of how big is the opportunity, it was huge. And it's a beautiful piece of architecture. Two-thirds of the engineering is actually underground because of the flight path. And, you know, it's got all this counterbalancing between the bowl inside. I love architecture. The bowl inside and the canopy that sits above these two buildings that a YouTube theater, which hosts thousands, about 15,000 people, and 80 to 100,000 person stadium. But the whole roof is a giant digital screen. When you're flying out of LAX, the whole thing, you can see the game that's going on from the sky. There's 3,000 screens within the stadium itself. It's got the biggest hanging screen in the world, which has got outside and inside visuals. And you think, my God, that's way too much. But when you're in there, you feel like you're in the game from every part of the stadium. It's unbelievable. Like, it's as a piece of digital art, it's spectacular. So we got involved in how does the stadium then connect with the campus? So it's a 300-acre site, 12,500 parking spaces, 17 individual car parks. There's vehicular routing, there's pedestrian routing and crowd flow movement. So we got involved in the wayfinding component of it. And that's really, how do you navigate cars safely through the environment to their destinations? How do you get people and crowds safely through the environment to their destinations? And then, of course, how do you connect them with products and services? Where do I buy the hat? Where do I get some food? How do I connect with social media? How do I get on the Wi-Fi? All those things. So digital signage is that way to get people connected into the experience of the environment. So that's where we came into it. It's about 300 digital touch points, big LED panels all the way through, directing cars and people through the environment. And the digital real estate became available. And we said, well, let's not waste it. Let's connect people with all the cool things that are going on. Is it brand? Is it social media? Is it next ticket? Dynamic QR coding, things like that. So we were fortunate enough to work with a chap there called Scarpy. And he's the CTO who ran the build project. He's now CTO of the LA Rams and part of Cronky Sports and Entertainment and Arsenal as well. He came from Walt Disney. The whole thing is, get people out of queues, get them engaging with the environment, and it increases profits, but the people are happier. You know, it's a win-win situation. So take this kind of thinking and apply it to a sports and entertainment campus. So nobody really did it or has even considered trying to do it at that scale. So we're very fortunate to work with him.
I don't know if anyone will be able to pick this up by your accent, but you're based in Australia. So how does an Australian company come to work on a massive project in Los Angeles? So how did that relationship come about?
Well, if you're Australian, you'd hear my accent and you go, you're not really Australian, you're English. I can hear it because they all call me out. So originally I was English, but I came out 20 or so years ago. And now I've picked up a bit of a twang. And so I suppose I'm a mongrel. I don't fit in anywhere. And I've worked all over the world in advertising and past lives, big brand agencies, things like that. I suppose we got on the world stage. I got in through an organization called the Society of Experiential Graphic Design in the US. And it's like big brand moments at airports, universities, and like big public spaces. I really love getting involved in that community. I actually sat on the board of directors 6 years in the US and got to know a lot of people. And through that network, we got introduced to various architectural firms, some of the bigger players, obviously. And everybody was talking about the vision of what was possible. But then you end up with what technology actually delivers on an enterprise scale. And it's pretty limiting and it's pretty old and it takes years for them to innovate. So that's where we kind of saw the opportunity. We went, well, I do experience design and here's all the technology that's currently available. It's not good enough. Let's bridge that gap. Let's create something that actually delivers on the experience that everybody's talking about what the future is. So that's where PAM was kind of born, I suppose.
That now translates from not just doing the wayfinding, but also doing some of the digital assets on game day. Is that right?
Yeah, we work directly with the LA Rams on preparing their game day fan experience content, whether they're connecting with social media, hashtag Rams House, you know. We've got a dynamic QR coding system, so it will put a value proposition on the screen. Yeah, connect with our social media. And then it pops up with a QR code. And you know what to do with a QR code? You lift your phone up, it picks it up, and you are straight to wherever that digital endpoint needs to be. So whether you're buying merchandise, buying food, seeing what the halftime show is, and you've got Taylor Swift or whoever, you know, the amazing act is there. But that fan experience is viscerally connected through those digital signs to the fans in that environment. And then they become the amplification and the voice to that, because once you've connected them, they then start sharing that with other people. So it's kind of like this ricochet effect that just starts everything off. But you've got to connect with them at some point. And that's what the digital signs offer.
The Rams have set up this technology alliance of which you're like a founding member. I guess with a stadium like that, and as you said, like you were talking about how the technology hadn't reached the point yet where you wanted it to, so you brought it forward. Is that now, like, you're even at that point with the stadium, it's not even probably realized its potential yet? Is that part of what that technology alliance is about?
Yeah, but it's also taking that technology and working out how you can apply it to other facilities that are under their ownership and management, training facilities, other adjacent properties that are connected to it. So big retail environments, there's a big retail environment that's built there. There's other stadiums, there's connected district strategies, which is kind of like we're really talking towards smart cities now. How do you build a smart city? Well, first of all, you start connecting all those data and touch points and make it livable and enjoyable for the people who are there. So part of that technology alliance is getting some like-minded people who are going, well, do I want to accept the status quo or do I want to challenge it? Not just for the sake of challenging it. It's not David and Goliath thing. It's just going, that's really painful. There's so much friction and it costs a huge amount of money. And I'm listening to people who have no idea about experience design. So well, why don't we talk to how do you actually improve that person's day? Let's start there, you know, and putting the customer at the heart of everything is the most important thing. Obviously, money rules the world and you need the sponsors to come in and pick up the bill, but you really want to improve that fan experience. So I think the LA Rams Technology Alliance is incubating in those technology innovations and creating a new platform for, you know, trialing and testing. How do people interact with content? What do they want? Because at the end of the day, the data doesn't lie. You know, people can make things up. Oh, I think this and I assume that. The data wasn't lie. You look at the cold, hard facts and you go, well, that's reality. Okay, well, let's listen to that. It's like a consensus or a vote.
Yeah, in some ways, maybe more honest than a vote, because even at a ballot box, people can trick themselves into ticking the wrong box. I'd like to talk about sponsors in a minute, but I think that point you made about smart cities and best way to like to engage with fans, that's really, really interesting. What have you discovered through the partnership, through working with the Rams, through working on the Hollywood Park project that you didn't know when you like started and when you put in the technology?
That's a very good question. What do we know now? Short answer is a lot. There's insights about fans. There's an understanding of operations. There is an understanding of people. You know, once upon a time, there was the old saying, you know, you don't get fired for specifying IBM. But today, if you specify something like that, IBM or some big old beast, you probably will get fired because it's like, what are you doing? Seriously? You're going to bring this archaic technology into play here? It isn't safer. It's not better. It's proven that there's new insights and technologies out there that are far superior that can be applied at scale safely and securely. So I think my personal biggest insight is that there is a huge amount of opportunity in the world right now to disrupt the status quo and create new ways to engage fans with new and interesting types of content. And there is that real opportunity of changing the way fans see content. It's not just like, oh, I just saw it on a billboard. I looked at it, but I've got to try and, you know, with advertising, there's recognition, recall and response. So I recognized it, Coca-Cola logo. I got there and I recalled it. Oh yeah, there's that logo. And the response is like, oh, I'll buy it. You know, so you don't need that anymore because someone pops something on screen. Hey, do you want that? You lift your phone up, you scan the QR code. Boom. Oh, here it is. It's on my phone. That thing I saw is on my phone. I'm now interacting with that content. I'm making a purchase. I'm doing something that is a real visceral connection to that brand or that sponsored opportunity. And that's where it's changing. 5 years ago, people were saying to me here in Sydney, working at the, you know, working with the city, working with big government agencies, oh, QR codes, ooh, no way. Nobody will ever use those things. And I'm like, it's just a way of getting someone to not type in a URL. That's all it is. I want them to go to this specific page on a website for this campaign, not go to the website, click, 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 and find it. I want to take them right there. So the QR code is a way for them to scan it and go straight to that experience. People didn't understand that. And then all of a sudden, you know, the horrendous pandemic hits and everyone's like, well, I've got to scan to check in. And, you know, my 88-year-old mother, you know, she's got no problem with it. Scan, I'm there. Cool. I know what I'm getting. And it's everywhere now. So it's prolific. So the QR code tech is a reality and we're engaging with it.
I mean, QR code tech has been around for a while. Yeah, as you said, people were kind of like not that impressed by it. What are the big wow bits of tech that like are super impressive on the site that people might be like, oh, right, yeah, I've not heard of that before?
So there's technology there that you don't see. Everyone knows Wi-Fi. So what Wi-Fi is just they scan it, I'm on the Wi-Fi, oh, my cellular network's like crapping out. So now I can connect to the data that I need. But there's a new type of Wi-Fi that's coming along, and it's called private networks. It's not released at the moment, but it's coming to, you know, a smart city near you at some point in the future. But you'd scan, and I don't know if you know, an iPhone can have up to 15 eSIMs at the same time. So you can scan, get your eSIM on your phone in that geographic location, get cellular connectivity, which is way, way, way superior to Wi-Fi connectivity. And you've got a guaranteed data connection. So you can download and stream all sorts of content to it. So those kind of technologies will be coming soon in the next wave of stadiums as they come online. So everything's about the connectivity layer. So how do telcos connect to you? And there's some groups like Bolden Networks who are really kind of making the telcos more honest. They're challenging them to get deals within these large environments rather than just owning the whole pipeline. So there's that layer. And then there's the application layer. Things like, when you scan the QR code and you jump into our mobile device, or you've got the screens up on the wall and they're changing content relative to the event or operations that are going on there to improve the fan experience. And then you've got the analytics layer. And everyone goes, oh, get your data pool. And it's like, yeah, what are you doing with it? Ask the question, why do you want it first? And then what are you going to do with it next? So, and it could be really simple. Don't get too clever. There's plenty of clever people in the world, but they'll fry your brain with something that you can't act on. So you go, well, can we just improve security a little bit? Can we reduce the lines on the concession queues a little bit? Okay, if you can incrementally keep improving things, which you can now with data, you know what the answers are and you know how to achieve them. And technology, you just keep tweaking and you keep improving the experience. So it's more profitable for the vendors and the brands that operate in those spaces. It's more pleasurable for the people who are in there, and it's safer. So it kind of ticks so many boxes. It's definitely understanding those three layers is, I suppose, where the big insights are.
And coming at this from a sports business angle, I mean, we mentioned sponsors, it's probably a good time to talk about it. How does this, the PAM technology, help those partners that are plugged in around Hollywood Park and SoFi?
Well, at the moment, it's a way for the teams to present their content to fans so the fans are engaged earlier on. So it's us versus them. That's today. That's what it's about. And you understand it from a distance, from the campus. It integrates with ticketing. We're working with Formula One in Las Vegas and integrating with the whole ticketing experience. We're doing the Australian Open next year. And they've got like 1 million visitors. So, during that event, that time period. So we're working on these big mega events now. And the first thing you need to do is get your house in order. And that's wayfinding. And everyone goes, oh, wayfinding is this like super clever discipline. Yeah, it is. But it's really knowing who's where, what's your security posture, where are your entry points, where are your accessible pathways. Make it as inclusive as you can on year one. And next year, what do you do? Look at the data. Keep improving it. Keep improving it. Bit by bit, you kind of like get your housekeeping in order. Once you put your housekeeping in order and you know who's going, what, when, where, and how, and you do it efficiently and effectively, so people are going, oh, that was okay, or that's a good experience. It's kind of, great is what you're going for. Good's okay, and, so you can work towards it. I don't think you're failing. But the interlayer of then sponsors connecting with those fans, I think you've got to do it in a way that creates trust. And what I mean by that is you can either go, I've captured you, Tom. You're walking in, bang. I know you like burgers. Bang, here's a burger. And you're like, oh, well, hang on a sec. That just doesn't feel natural.
It's a bit like when your phone, like you feel like it's been listening to you because the thing you were just talking about comes up as an Instagram ad. It's all a bit too creepy. You don't want that experience.
Oh, yeah. But that's privacy. So if you look at Tim Cook's view on privacy that he put out several years ago, I think it's bang on. humanity doesn't want people like eyeballing who's who and sending them information unsolicited. That's not cool. That's not cool at all. But if I go into an environment and I feel safe and I'm a fan and I feel confident and comfortable with that, I can slowly open doors and go, yep, I'm interested in that kind of content because I know it's going to be good and relevant to me. It's not going to be rubbish. And if it's about improving my day or giving me offers to upgrade my day, so there's a commercial side to it, but, you know, you've got an option. Yes, no. You know, oh, I've got some more money in my pocket. Cool. Do an upgrade. Or I might go over here and I might buy that to my kid or whatever it may be, or my friend. So I think environments right now and marketing today is very push, and it's pushing it at you. And it's the old school kind of like, you know, just stick a billboard on the side of the road, see it enough time, recognition, recall, and response. Or stop to a gas station, I bought a can of Coke. Not that I'm flogging Coke here, but yes.
It's the one everyone goes to. It's fine. Other soft drinks are available.
Yeah, completely. Completely. But yeah, I think understanding, it's all about the user experience, Tom. Get back to the user. What makes you feel comfortable when you're there? What makes you feel uncomfortable? Everybody else has got to feel pretty much the same thing. So you've got to put yourself in the shoes of the fan, the operator, the security guard, the vendor, and you go, well, what can you do to incrementally make your environment a little bit better? That's kind of where we come from most of the time, is working with those owners, operators, organizations, brands to work out how are they going to improve that experience. And our platform delivers that for them. It's the tool for them to deliver it to that environment.
I was going to ask if there's anything specific in the PAM tech, in your digital wayfinding, that like helps with that sort of monetization. I'm not particularly technical, but I wonder if there's anything in there that you guys do in, like, specifically that facilitates that.
Our special source is called Playbooks. That comes from like a boardroom Deloitte kind of consultancy background. But what's your playbook on this day? Well, it's, I need a playbook for critical events. How do I respond to this terrible situation? Or, well, hey, Taylor Swift's in town. So, okay, let's make sure all the branding's like exactly right. Or what's the inbound journey look like? Well, let's get everybody, the most important information is getting them into gates, but also letting them know, hey, there's merchandise over here, and connect with our social media. Woo, having a great time during the event. Oh, you know, there's food over there. There's some options there. There's a retail environment down the road you can go to afterwards. Hey, we'll grab pizzas afterwards. And on the way out, hey, did you have a great time? Hey, do you know what the next concert is? X. Scan this. Boom. Hey, look, I booked his tickets. We'll be back there next month. So it's about, again, engaging the user on all aspects of their journey, not just, here's a map. Good luck. Here's a digital map, digital signs that are responding to what's happening in the environment. So the playbooks and the scene management of, you know, inbound, during, outbound scene, you know, roll in, you know, getting supplies into the right location, roll out. Let's get everybody out of here. You know, where's the parking? All those kind of aspects. But the commercial layer is really enabling those organizations to connect with their sponsors and go, hey, look, we do 20 million impressions on these digital signs over 10 games. Are you interested in getting some of your content out there, Mr. Brand X? You know, well, actually, yeah. Well, we're going to do social media. We'll do something about this thing. We'll do something about halftime. And you could put your brand in there. Do you want to be part of that journey? Sure. So they can then commercialize the value in their fans, who are their audience, because they're part of that tribe, connecting with that brand. So there are custodians in there. It's not just burning eyeballs, like, you know, a bunch of NFL fans are like, way, and there's something that's like a Nivea ad, and you're like, what's that doing there? you contextualize it. You send the right message at the right time to that audience.
I think I saw that you delivered 3.5 million impressions on your digital signage so far last year. That's a fair chunk of inventory for brands to get stuck into.
That's right. And they're also contextualized impressions. So before a game, you get 80% impressions. During a game, it drops down to 10% because those signs might be on, but nobody's looking at them. Then after a game, it jumps back up to 60%. So it depends on the level of engagement relative to the amount of people walking past them and where they're walking from. There's a rideshare drop-off showing. There's there's where all the coaches arrive. There's certain areas and certain locations where you can contextualize the information. And part of our system is being able to dynamically plan and then implement different content on different groups of signs and capture all the impressions that are running at their time and then report them back to the sponsors. So the sponsors are like, cool, that's great, thanks. You know, and it's not like the back end of a car park where you're just flashing a sign that nobody's looking at. You know, I can see this is where the main traffic is. It makes sense.
It's fascinating stuff. I feel like I could keep on asking questions forever. Stephen, thank you very much. I'm aware this is a bit later for you than it is for me, but we appreciate you coming on the pod.
No, that's great. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, Tom, a great interview there. It's sports tech has been all the conversation here at Sports Pro HQ over the past couple of weeks as we gear up for Ignition 2023, taking place in the afternoon of the 4th of October. Tom, are you excited for Ignition this year?
It does look like a really interesting event this year. I think we talked about it last week, but well worth checking out if you're in that sports and technology space. Great meeting point for companies on both sides, I think. And at Sports Pro, we've definitely found that to be the case with like some of the companies that we've had through it are now big parts of our ecosystem and things that we use every day.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the exciting things for this year's agenda is there's sessions that I guess sort of like set the tone, look at the different, you know, different technologies and how they can be used. And then they're kind of paired with sessions that are more case study focused on how they're actually being used and, you know, what results you can derive from it. So I'm looking to see the sort of that array of the demo sprints, the case studies and the keynote speakers. So yeah, tune in on the 4th of October, free to attend, free to register. So head to ignition.sports where you can register now.
I think that's it for this week, Paul, isn't it, George?
It certainly is. Sam and Tom, I'll see you soon.
Thanks very much, mate.